It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Due to the graphic nature of this cult's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of material that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13.
A tall, charismatic man with silver hair and a winsome smile plies a 17-year-old boy with drinks. It's his fourth or fifth glass. The boy can't remember. His head swims. The room looks fuzzy.
The boy fears what would happen if his father caught him drinking. In his defense, it's hard to say no to another glass when God is serving the drinks.
God tells the boy not to worry. Their souls are not bodies, and the angels want them to be together.
God locks them inside a private chamber and tells the boy to disrobe. The boy obeys, shivering.
God whispers that everything will be okay. The angels want the boy to submit to him. This is all part of the plan. Bodies will decay, but souls will remain.
The boy lies back on the bed. The room fades. God instructs the boy to let go. He can feel his soul leaving his body.
The last thing the boy hears is God promising that he will hear him calling in the afterlife. Hi, I'm Greg Polson.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And this is Cults on the Parcast Network. Today we're taking a deep dive into the life of Robert Earl Burton, a former elementary school teacher who became the founder of the Fellowship of Friends.
You can listen to previous episodes of Cults, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, wherever you listen to podcasts. A new episode comes out every Tuesday.
A lot of you have asked how you can support the show. And if you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and on Twitter @ParcastNetwork. During the 1970s in the San Francisco Bay Area, Robert Earl Burton founded the Fellowship of Friends, who are famous for their persistent preparations for mankind's destruction and, somewhat charmingly, their vineyards.
A student of the self-development method known as the Fourth Way, Burton cribbed dogma from various sources to form his own ideology. He claims that 44 angels guide him, including Leonardo da Vinci.
Today, the Fellowship of Friends claims an estimated 2,000 members worldwide, about 600 of whom reside at the cult's headquarters in Oregon House, California. Over the years, they've prepared for catastrophe, believing they shall remain to rebuild civilization under Burton and his angels, while the rest perish.
In part one, we'll focus on the life of Robert Earl Burton and the influences that led to the creation of the Fellowship of Friends. In part two, we'll focus on the cult's disillusioned ex-members, lawsuits involving tax fraud and sexual abuse, and Burton's latest Armageddon predictions. Robert Earl Burton once said of his birth, quote, "I was told I was shot out of my mother's womb. I was the last born child, and my mother had to reach down and catch me very quickly. Charles Brennan said, 'Are you sure she caught you?'" End quote.
It's hard to be sure when it comes to Burton, who tends to spin the truth to suit his own agenda. Even his birth is shrouded in mystery. The official Fellowship of Friends roster says that he was born on May 12, 1939. However, Burton has claimed throughout the years that he was born on May 4th, May 5th, May 11th, and May 13th.
The location of his birth is also debatable. Burton's birth certificate officially states that he was born in Mineral, Arkansas, yet his biography says that he was born in Little Rock. Burton himself has told followers he was born an hour north in Enola, Arkansas.
In fact, there are limited sources available on Burton's life prior to 1970. The few that exist mainly come from Burton himself. Admittedly, he isn't a reliable source. However, it's the lies Burton tells that most reveal who he is.
First, we'll start with the indisputable facts. In a 1940 census record of Mineral Township, Pulaski County, Arkansas, a one-year-old Bobby Burton was listed as the son of Edgar and Velma E. Burton, the youngest of four siblings. At the time, Edgar worked as a stock dealer, and the family owned a farm.
In 1943, when Burton was 4 years old, Velma uprooted him and his siblings to the San Francisco Bay Area. Edgar, for unknown reasons, stayed behind. What happened to Burton throughout the next two decades remains mostly unknown except to him.
Vanessa's going to take over on the psychology here and throughout the episode. Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Greg. Rumors claim that Burton was sexually abused by his mother. According to American clinical psychologist David Lisak, who conducted interviews with male survivors of sexual abuse, quote, "The family environments in which the men were raised were often characterized by disruption and/or violence," end quote.
The men Lisak interviewed came from families fractured by a parent's absence, abuse, and addiction. So for Burton, the inexplicable cross-country move and Edgar's disappearance would certainly have affected him accordingly. Yet, what about his siblings? Did Velma target them? And how would they have reacted to her abuse of Burton?
If the household was abusive, then Burton's siblings were likely no help. According to author Alice Miller, quote, "Within this family structure, the children are the oppressed. If they have younger siblings, they are provided with a place to abreact their own humiliation," end quote. As the youngest, Burton's siblings would have likely turned on him to protect themselves.
Rumors allege that Burton was also sexually abused by at least one of his sisters. If true, this may have been their way of establishing the family pecking order. Given the time he grew up in and the fact he was male, any accusations Burton would have made would likely have been ignored, if not ridiculed.
According to Lisak, some men explicitly told a parent what was happening to them and were still rebuffed and offered no protection. We can't confirm whether Burton confided to anyone about the abuse, but his heavy-handed censorship of his own past implies that there is something Burton doesn't want known.
According to Burton, in 1949, the son of Henry J. Kaiser, an American shipyard industrialist, gave a 10-year-old Burton a tour of his family's vast property. The young Burton was impressed with the fact that Kaiser's son was wealthy enough to have his own road to drive his own car on.
The exposure to such a lavish lifestyle would be a definitive moment in Burton's life, to the degree that he would ascribe it as a spiritual experience. Burton said, quote, "It was like being admitted into paradise. That was the preparation for entering paradise when that time comes. It's not so far away, in fact," end quote.
Burton may have internalized the idea that prosperity was how he could escape from his family and seize back control of his life. It would have been frustrating to deal with the abuse, knowing other boys had it easier.
Burton later channeled his aggression into sports, specifically tennis. It isn't known how or when he picked up the sport, but Burton claims he defeated the California singles tennis champion in 1959 at the age of 20. He also claims that he graduated from San Jose State University in 1963 at the age of 24 with a degree in education.
Yet an alternate source claims Burton's degree was in speech pathology, and he played tennis only occasionally. Either way, after college, Burton got a job as a fourth grade teacher at Spring Hill Elementary School in Lafayette, California. On the surface, Burton was doing well. He was an average 27-year-old professional, popular with students and faculty alike. Carol Blackburn, a fellow teacher at Spring Hill, recalls of Burton, quote, "He was kind of one of the stars. Everybody loved him," end quote. Burton, however, wasn't content with his mundane existence.
Burton says of this time, "I had a nice apartment with a pool outside, a new car, money in the bank, and all of that. But I sat down and said, 'This is nothing.' So I began to look for something." Like many in the 1960s, he got caught up in the spiritual movement craze.
When Spring Hill closed for a winter break, Burton went on a journey that took him to the Nepenthe restaurant in Big Sur on the Monterey Peninsula in Northern California. He claims to have found his magnetic center here on December 25th, 1963.
Upon his return to Spring Hill, Burton had made a dramatic change. Blackburn recalls, he was dressed like a hippie, complete with a headband. While the school administration likely found his new appearance and attitude disruptive, Burton felt they were stifling his magnetic center.
He was forced to resign on March 17, 1967. But what led to his swift departure remains in dispute. Burton said the administration felt he was too friendly with his students. Already at odds with them over his fashion, they were likely looking for any excuse to dismiss him. However, rumors claim Burton was asked to leave because of inappropriate behavior with a group of male students on a camping trip.
Choosing a profession that would put him near potential victims fits the pattern of child predators like Burton, who were reportedly sexually abused as children. The predators seemingly set themselves up in a vicious cycle of eventual exposure. Yet, subconsciously or not, they may seek to get caught. According to trauma and addiction specialist Patrick J. Carnes, Ph.D., as adults, they feel most sexual when it's dangerous or risky. One of the characteristics is that with each episode, they take a greater risk.
The Spring Hill Elementary School incident would not be the last time Burton was accused of sexual misconduct. It got worse for Burton when, less than 3 months after he resigned, his father Edgar died in June 1967. He was 61 years old.
Unemployed and having lost Edgar, Burton was at a crossroads in the literal and figurative sense.
As per the fad in the 60s, Burton hitchhiked everywhere. On September 5th, 1967, in Berkeley, California, a doctor or professor who had picked up Burton invited him to a meeting at the house on 350 Page Street.
The meeting was held by thespian and leader of several controversial cult groups, Alexander Francis Horn. Burton claims he developed a connection with Horn right away. Horn's influence on Burton would be absolute. From that moment on, Burton was his most loyal follower.
We'll learn more about this fateful partnership after this.
Now, back to the story. On September 5th, 1967, Robert Burton met Alexander Francis Horn. Alex Horn introduced Burton to the belief system that would change the rest of his life.
Alexander Horn was born on August 14th, 1929. From a young age, Horn was no stranger to trauma. As with Burton, there are few details about Horn's past.
Here's what we do know. On February 8, 1935, when Horn was five, a fire broke out in his Chicago, Illinois home after a match lit by his mother ignited the bedclothes.
Horn's screams alerted his neighbors, saving their lives. However, his trauma likely didn't begin or end with this incident. Horn hasn't said much of his childhood, but did admit that his mother, Laura, was abusive. Horn said, "My mother bullied me to death and controlled every move I made."
According to Burton, Horn's parents passed away when he was young. A 1940 census record confirms that an 11-year-old Horn had been an inmate of the Marks Nathan Jewish Orphan Home for the past 5 years, a place known as a refuge for Jewish children whom life had handed a lousy deal. In 1949, a 20-year-old Horn attended the University of Chicago and became active in the local theater scene. From here, he became a well-known actor and playwright, people skills that would certainly help him become a convincing cult leader in later years.
From this point, the exact order of events in his life get ambiguous. At some point in his late 20s or early 30s, Horn became interested in the Fourth Way, a self-development movement.
Horn was likely introduced to the Fourth Way through a woman named Anne Barrage. It's unclear as to how the two met, but either way, she soon became his wife.
The two eventually felt so confident in their ability to practice and teach the Fourth Way that they opened a school in Sonoma County, California, in the early 1960s, known as the Theater of All Possibilities.
Alexander Horn and his wife, Anne Barrage, would both go on to be cult leaders in their own right, separate from Robert Earl Burton, but all three of these soon-to-be cult leaders grounded their teaching in the ideology of the Fourth Way.
By the time Horn and Barrage started studying the Fourth Way, it was already a well-worn set of ideals. but it didn't truly catch on in the Western world until the 1950s.
The Fourth Way is a belief system developed from several other Eastern religions. It was founded in the early 1900s by two men named George Ivanovich Gurchev and Pyotr Demyanovich, P.D., Ouspensky.
In 1911, after traveling the world in search of spiritual truth, Gurdjieff took an oath to live his life through the ways of the fakirs of Sufi Islam, the monks of China, and the yogis of India. He believed that it was only through a combination of these three ways that mankind could achieve true spiritual awakening. He appropriately called this the Fourth Way.
Meanwhile, around the time that Gurdjieff was developing the Fourth Way, Ouspensky started writing a novel called Tertium Organum, which he self-published in 1912. The novel addressed the limits of man's consciousness and became a hit with the Russian intelligentsia. One of the many who had read Tertium Organum was Gurdjieff, perhaps sensing a kindred spirit.
In April 1915, the two met in a busy cafe and began to expand upon the Fourth Way. They struck up a friendship and developed an ideology that, 50 years later, would bring together two similarly kindred spirits, Alexander Horn and Robert Earl Burton. According to the teachings, mankind is affected by three types of influences. Ouspensky called these the A, B, and C influences.
A influences are things in the environment which subconsciously manipulate all men every day. They can include race relations, political affiliation, national pride, consumed entertainment, and family values. While these are not necessarily bad things and can help someone become a good person and informed citizen, they are not enough. According to Gurdjieff, the average man can't advance spiritually if he only listens to A influences.
B influences are similar to A influences, but differ in origin. B influences have been created with the deliberate purpose of motivating the person toward enlightenment. Religious texts such as the Bible, the Torah, and the Quran are some examples. With a B influence, a man could take the first step toward consciousness.
But the most important influence on a man's spiritual journey are C influences. Only those who have been spiritually awakened can perceive them. The only way to feel them is through contact with a source or a spiritually enlightened being. Typically, this source would be the teacher guiding the student towards enlightenment. Fourth Way students elect to follow their C influences, surrendering everything to the guidance of their teachers.
In a way, Ouspensky advocated the surrender of followers' free will. According to the Fourth Way, the average person is incapable of actually making decisions because the average person is a mess of contradictions. In general, people entertain a myriad of conflicting thoughts about their wants, needs, and feelings. Ouspensky believes these thoughts headbutted one another and blocked C influences. Therefore, a teacher needed to guide the student with a steady hand.
In and of itself, the Fourth Way is largely about mindfulness and surrender to the forces around you. It aims to elevate its students, not make them into mind-controlled puppets. But neither Gurdjieff nor Ouspensky could have predicted that years later, Alexander Horn and Robert Earl Burton would twist their teachings to suit their own ends and use the surrender of free will to control the followers they intended to prey upon.
This could have been in large part due to the fact that Alexander Horn never studied the Fourth Way under a qualified teacher. According to author William Patrick Patterson, Horn's understanding of the Fourth Way came from reading books and from his wife, Anne Barrage. Barrage took part in a 10-month experimental program hosted by J.G. Bennett, an ex-Gurdjieff student who merged the Fourth Way with other methods. In other words, Horn never received official Fourth Way training himself.
Still, this factual oversight hasn't prevented Burton from claiming that Horn was a legitimate Fourth Way teacher. After his first meeting with Alexander Horn in 1967, Burton was hooked. He was convinced this man could lead him to enlightenment and a higher purpose.
Burton happily threw himself into the teachings of the Fourth Way, becoming aware of his A and B influences. Horn encouraged his growth, assuring him that it was only a matter of time until his C influences also became revealed.
And soon after, they were. In 1968, 3 months after he became Horn's student, Burton was driving in Modesto, California, when an oncoming car struck his Volkswagen Beetle.
Burton blacked out. He awoke hours later as the doctors rolled him out of the operating room.
Burton had either 100 or 144 stitches in his head. The number changes every time he recounts the story. Visibly shaken, Burton consulted with his teacher, Horn. He was concerned about how the accident could affect his influences. Horn reportedly told Burton not to worry, that his scars were precious.
Apparently, Burton still agrees. Burton claims that in the shock of the car accident, his sea influence was finally revealed to him, and it taught him to appreciate the accident as an act of God. However, while Burton may have seen the accident as a blessing, it may have done irreparable damage to his orbitofrontal cortex.
Damage to this area of the brain can result in unhindered, impulsive behavior. This can include excessive swearing, compulsive gambling, nymphomania, and substance abuse. Sufferers may undergo a significant change in personality.
If Burton did suffer a traumatic brain injury, it may have changed more than his personality.
According to Dr. R. James R. Blair, Ph.D., and Lisa Cipollotti, Ph.D., quote, patients with frontal lobe lesions have been described as presenting diminished social awareness and a lack of concern for social rules, end quote. It was likely this acquired sociopathy that put Burton on a path towards becoming a cult leader. As we'll see, his lack of empathy and inhibition would influence his actions for the rest of his life.
Burton soon recovered and rededicated himself to the Fourth Way. He became a regular at the Red Mountain Ranch, the property in Sonoma, where Horn and Barrage ran their Fourth Way school. At the time, the ranch was surrounded by 457 acres of land. 71 of those acres were used to farm grapes.
The Theater of All Possibilities wasn't just a school. It was a working theater as well. The theater existed, so Horn would have the opportunity to put on plays loosely adapted from the works of Gurdjieff.
From its inception, Horn treated the school for the cash cow it was. In the 60s, people were willing to pay anything for spiritual enlightenment. The counterculture movement convinced many well-meaning truth seekers that alternative religions like the Fourth Way held answers they needed for a fulfilling life.
And that fulfillment came at a steep price. Horn earned about $40,000 a month from the theater. $20,000 of that was extorted from his students as class fees, and $20,000 from the ticket sales his students made on the street.
Horn set a weekly quota for each student, and if his students failed to meet that quota, they were savagely beaten or fined. Horn also beat his overworked students whenever they fell asleep, made a noise backstage during a play, or cried. His students were so preoccupied with theater productions that they often neglected their own families.
According to Carnes, quote, loyalty to a person who is toxic, exploitive, or destructive to you is a form of insanity, end quote. When they asked why they didn't leave, Horn's students either admitted they felt the theater group gave them a purpose or confessed that the abuse destroyed them mentally.
Despite these atrocities, Horn knew how to keep his students on a leash. He treated them to fine dining, dancing, and orgies. Many of these parties were held at the Red Mountain Ranch. Not only did Burton probably witness and participate in these atrocities, he likely took notes.
Horn also invented catastrophes that always needed donations from his students to solve. This is what Ross refers to as coercive persuasion, where victims are taught to think of what's best for their leader and not for themselves.
In 1969, Barrage left Horn and the Red Mountain Ranch, taking several students with her. It's believed this was due to Horn's infidelity and overall narcissism, although there aren't many objective facts about the split. Either way, Horn soon started a relationship with actress Sharon Gans, who quickly became his second wife.
Despite the shakeup in leadership, life at the Red Mountain Ranch continued business as usual. Burton and the other students would till grapevines with only hand tools, mind-numbing, back-breaking work. Burton recalls the ordeal with an odd sense of pride. He notes, quote, I performed the humblest of tasks that the other students would not do, end quote. It may not be that surprising that Burton would ally himself with Horn. According to Carnes, quote, signs of betrayal bonding include misplaced loyalty, inability to detach, and self-destructive denial, end quote.
In Burton's mind, Horn was the ideal teacher, except for one thing. Horn forced the male students to participate in blood sports. Often these fights devolved into vicious free-for-alls. One student reportedly had the skin on his forehead torn off.
It's unclear as to why Horn felt these fights were justified or necessary, but Burton didn't condone them. He said, quote, "Force cannot break the lower self. Only love can do that," end quote. It was through this and his natural charisma that Burton won over many of the male students and developed a small following within the school. To some, he too could provide the path to see influences.
Until it came to light that Burton was trading anal sex for spiritual enlightenment. Horn, a notorious homophobe, ordered the others to savagely beat Burton for this transgression. Their relationship was never the same, and Horn regularly subjected Burton to abuse. After 18 months of this treatment, Horn and Burton finally split ways. Many believe Horn kicked Burton out for continuing to sleep with other men on the ranch.
Burton maintains that Horn cut him off from the group without notice. Either way, Burton was back to square one. Unable to find employment, the 31-year-old hitchhiked to San Francisco and began aimlessly wandering the Bay Area. And it was in this span of time that Burton began to reinterpret the fourth way and gain the trust of willing victims who would follow him to their deaths.
We'll see how Burton reimagines his new religion in a moment.
Now, back to the story.
In 1971, Robert Burton was kicked out of the Theater of All Possibilities for sleeping with other men in the cult. He hitchhiked his way to San Francisco, where he spent weeks wallowing in poverty, directionless. In the midst of this, Burton found himself taunted by memories of the affluence and wealth that Henry J. Kaiser's son had introduced Burton to as a kid. So close in distance, yet so far away in attainability. Burton obsessed over this as he continued to study the fourth way on his own.
As he studied in isolation, Burton began to develop his own interpretations of the religion. Unchecked by any teacher or guide, Burton convinced himself he was fully conscious to all influences. He came to believe his bad experiences were what Gurdjieff described as shocks. He later associated these shocks with the higher powers of sea influence. These higher powers were 44 influential figures from literature, art, the Bible, and history, who Burton identified as conscious beings.
The 44 conscious beings, or angels, as Burton also called them, included Gurdjieff, Ouspensky, and Italian Renaissance artist Leonardo da Vinci. The angels existed on an astral plane and would cause a nuclear holocaust that would wipe out the Earth. They would only save Burton, who was their prophet and mouthpiece.
In the midst of this self-discovery, Burton eventually found his way home to his mother, Velma. He lived with her while teaching tennis on the side. Yet Burton felt it was his true destiny to use his network of angels to teach high school students about consciousness. He was convinced society was on the verge of collapse and that it was his job to spiritually prepare teenagers for after the apocalypse.
But high school kids aren't always a readily available population. So Burton would have to settle on the next best thing, the emotionally vulnerable. On December 31st, 1969, Bonita Guido, a shy 33-year-old housewife and mother of two, was sitting near the fireplace at a friend's New Year's Eve party. Burton says he came over and asked Bonita for a dance. Afterward, they sat down to talk.
That said, a conflicting account claims Burton badgered Bonita while she was high on drugs. Bonita, however, claims intuition told her she would meet someone at the party who would change her life. After the party, Burton went back to Velma's house in Walnut Creek, California. Bonita went back to her family in Pleasant Hill.
Burton answered the phone just after midnight on January 1st, 1970. It was Bonita. She got his phone number from the party hostess and needed to see him right away. They met at the Copper Penny Restaurant on University Avenue in Berkeley. He considers this to be the day the Fellowship of Friends was born.
Bonita asked Burton what she would need to do to become his student. Burton explained he couldn't teach her unless she paid him. When asked about the cost, Burton told Bonita to consider how much her soul was worth. After some thought, she settled on a conservative $90 a month.
Bonita and Burton had meetings alone until Bonita introduced Burton to David, her second husband. Then, the three of them began to study together during three-hour sessions at Bonita's house. But soon, the sessions alone didn't feel like enough. Bonita soon requested more alone time with Burton, who obliged.
As the first member of this new group Burton had started calling the Fellowship of Friends, Bonita was subjected to Burton's deceptiveness. According to anti-cult activist Rick Allen Ross, the goal was to change people without their knowledge. The deception would make students like Bonita susceptible to control under an authority figure like him.
Burton would have Bonita make her own clothes, stop dyeing her hair, and would exert control over her in a myriad of little ways. Little things that she acquiesced to as Burton attracted more students through word of mouth. Many who joined the Fellowship of Friends at this stage heard about it through loved ones who were already members.
Like Horn before him, Burton monopolized his students' time and money. This likely contributed to marriage problems the Guidos had been having for some time. They hosted Burton's meetings until others offered their homes. Since many of his students didn't own a car, Burton chauffeured them in his mother's car. Burton eventually decided he should purchase his own Volkswagen van and demanded the Guidos help him pay for it.
Something Bonita and David couldn't do. It turned out financial stress was a large part of their marital discord. They spared what they could, which Burton half-heartedly accepted, and eventually got his van. And with it, Bonita. It got to where Bonita spent more time with the Fellowship of Friends than with her husband. Bonita finally confessed to David that she had had an affair with another student. David filed for divorce shortly after.
The Guidos weren't the first relationship to fall apart under the Fellowship of Friends. In fact, Burton became infamous for destroying marriages. At least 37 couples separated within the first months of his group's inception. By the end of 1970, the Fellowship of Friends had only 26 members.
As befitting a prophet, Burton wanted a special oasis that would also serve as an ark for his students after the coming apocalypse. Burton admits that he borrowed the idea from Horn and the Red Mountain Ranch. But unlike the authoritarian and often violent rule under Alex Horn, Burton intended this oasis to be a place for he and his students to enjoy.
Bonita gave Burton $4,000 as seed money for his venture. Later, when Burton handed out envelopes to his students with instructions on how much they were individually required to contribute, Bonita was shocked that Burton wanted $800 despite her previous contribution. The students were given a specific deadline. Failure to pay meant they would be out of the Fellowship of Friends, and so Bonita forked over the extra funds.
Burton and his students found land in the Sierra foothills in Oregon House, California. When the property was purchased 6 months later, the Fellowship of Friends had 70 members, most of whom were from Northern California. Like Horn, Burton kept his students busy. They would landscape, cook, perform administrative duties, and construct a live-in compound on the property. Work began on the Oregon House compound, which was sometimes called Via del Sol, Spanish for the Way of the Sun. It was also occasionally called the Ranch. The goal was to convert the land into a heaven on earth with orchards, vineyards, fountains, and gardens.
Several students quit their jobs and relocated to the ranch. The rest stayed in the Bay Area to hold meetings for prospective students. Burton, like Horn, required absolute devotion. As proof of commitment, Burton asked his students to give their children away. He made it known that he saw children as a waste of higher energy.
Why take care of your kids when you can work toward utopia? The children who weren't relinquished were kept in a double-wide mobile home. They were allowed as far as the barn to milk cows, but were banned from Via del Sol. The children were often left unattended and had to pool money for bread.
Sometime in 1971, Burton registered the Fellowship of Friends as a nonprofit. By December 25, 1971, they expanded to 100 members. They also started to recruit at Lake Tahoe and Carmel.
As the Fellowship of Friends developed new centers, Burton decided it was time they reached out to those with no connection to current members. He chose an unconventional method. Burton printed several thousand bookmarks with the likenesses of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, along with phone numbers to centers that were recruitment fronts for the Fellowship of Friends.
His students slipped bookmarks into Fourth Way-themed books in bookstores and libraries throughout California. Members were encouraged to place bookmarks in stores wherever they traveled, which earned them the nickname, the Bookmark People.
According to author William Patterson, quote, "The logical assumption, of course, was that there was a connection between the bookmark and the books in which they were found," end quote. By Christmas Day 1972, the Fellowship of Friends had established centers in Los Angeles and Hawaii.
Over the next 6 months, more centers would appear in San Diego, Santa Barbara, and Sacramento. 2 to 3 members were chosen to direct each center. Sometimes additional members were asked to move to help start a center. They were known as supporting students.
In addition to bookmarks, advertisements appeared in local papers. In October 1973, centers opened in Seattle, Washington. In February 1974, more centers popped up in Portland, Oregon. These were so successful, Burton began to consider opening centers throughout the United States.
On December 25, 1975, Burton chose 60 members to open 10 centers in New York City, Pittsburgh, Miami, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, Philadelphia, Denver, and Phoenix. The chosen 60 set out for their designated cities on January 1, 1976.
Many moved into large homes that would function as teaching houses. These houses provided lodgings for center directors, supporting members, and members visiting from another city.
After the Fellowship of Friends spread across the United States, members traveled to England and Europe, and more centers arose. The Fellowship of Friends was on the rise, led by a charismatic, spiritual man known as Robert Burton.
However, behind closed doors, Burton was far from the holy man his followers loved. He had set his sights on certain members of the Fellowship of Friends with twisted intentions.
Next week, we'll see how Burton used his power to coerce his members into sexually abusive relationships as Fellowship of Friends spread around the globe.
Some were young seekers. Others were children of seekers. In the coming years, Burton would facilitate the abuse of a countless number of young adults, with a special subset sexually groomed into becoming his property.
Thanks again for tuning in to Cults. We'll be back with another episode next Tuesday.
Some of you have asked how you can help support the show. If you enjoy Cults, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. You can find Cults and all of Parcast's podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or on your favorite podcast directory.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork.
We'll see you next time.
Cults was created by Max Cutler and is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Paul Liebeskind, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Cults is written by Simone Fournilier and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson.